Three Ukrainian families find a foothold in a remote corner of Ireland. How temporary is their life there? No one knows. Today, I'm talking to the makers of a groundbreaking film about the lives and challenges of displaced Ukrainians who found themselves in Ireland. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like, subscribe, and definitely comment, especially on this one. Do share it with friends, acquaintances as well, so they can get better informed about what's happening in Ukraine and why it's so important to support Ukraine and Ukrainians. And of course, many people watching this will have had direct experience with Ukrainians in their communities. I hope that this video and the film that it's about will help people gain a better understanding of the challenges of displaced Ukrainians who've been forced out of their home cities by the Russian invasion. And today I'm going to be talking to three people involved in the creation of this fantastic film. Daniel James Baldwin is the director and producer, Stephen Lacey, the executive producer, and Daria Korsak, editor and translator. We should also mention two other people who are not present today are on the video, but who have played an instrumental role in the creation of this film. That is Hannah Tookie, the producer, and Jackie Tabor, the director of photography. Welcome to Silicon Curtain.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
Well, let's jump straight in here because people want to know, well, what's the film? What's it about? Why did you make it? What stage is it at? So, what is the film and what are you trying to achieve with the film? This is a question everyone's going to have a chance of answering, and then subsequent questions as we work through, I think we'll direct to individual people to avoid repetition. But I think you might all have a slightly different take on why this project's important. Let's start with Daria.
I think the main purpose of this project is to kind of change the perception of Ukrainians in local communities because even though the practical perception has been great, there are still some stereotypes that make people hide behind the label of refugees or displaced people. And to me, because I'm living this experience as well, it's important to break the stereotype and just show the lives of people as they are.
Daniel, you're very, very closely involved in the creative aspects of this film. What's your vision for what's going to end up on the screen?
Well, I mean, there's a story in that. I mean, it was something at the beginning and it's evolved into something else. But I guess if you are, right now, if I'm to explain what I hope to achieve with it, we've got three families who feature heavily in the film. It's about their lived experience in County Mayo, which is a rural community in Ireland. It's a really fascinating area, which we'll go into later in terms of the local history, and what the impact of the influx of refugees from Ukraine, or displaced people rather, from Ukraine has had there and other places like it. But I mean, essentially I want it to be a poetic film. I want it to be a film that has pathos for the people who we filmed with, who trusted us with their stories for 14 months. And as Daria says, I think that I ultimately, the film's purpose is to be able to speak to host communities and encourage them to, see these people who are new neighbors of theirs as people rather than social media specters or news headlines.
And we should turn to Stephen now and get his point of view on that before we, get into the next topic. Stephen, why are you involved in this, and why is this such a passion project for you?
So it's a really good question. So I care deeply about Ukraine. So I first went to Ukraine in 2006 and used to go to Mariupol for my kind of summer holidays. And it's a city that I care about, a city that I love passionately, a city where I've got lots of friends, and I've got lots of friends across the east. And when this brutal escalation occurred, of complete and utter devastation, I made a promise to my friends and also to St. Nicholas on the day of the bombing in February that I'd do everything in my power to help Ukraine, and not just for the shortcoming and for the victory, but also for the rest of my life. So I've been supporting a lot of kind of Ukrainian kind of initiatives, such as kind of Ukraine Institute. I speak a lot at the rallies and speak about the evil and brutality of kind of Russian propaganda. I've gone back and done a master's at School of Slavonic Studies on Ukrainian history and kind of and politics, and really looking at kind of Russian kind of propaganda. So when this happened, there was a lot of narratives, quite rightly, that were about the meta kind of narratives, the geopolitical. But I really wanted to kind of make a film that was about the human stories and bottom up to tell the big kind of meta kind of stories. So I had this idea that I really want to kind of film and understand displaced Ukrainians in a completely different area to where it was usually filmed, i.e. kind of big cities. And so I approached kind of Daniel with the kind of genesis of the idea. I think the other big area is that I'm really passionate about kind of outsiders. I run a research company and a cultural insight company called The Outsiders. I'm disabled myself, so I've kind of got a lobster hand and bow kind of leg. So the whole idea of outside and then coming inside was really, really important to me. But also just countering the brutality, the manipulation, and the complete darkness of Russian propaganda, which always feeds on outsiders.
And that's a fascinating point, isn't it? Because propaganda is an area I've become fascinated in. I have to declare an interest here. Steve and I met soon after the full-scale invasion because we're attending the same kind of events. And eventually you spot who are the repeat offenders going to all the different events. But Russian narratives, or any propaganda narratives for that matter, or even political spin, it negates the voice of individuals. It seems, it seeks to paper over whatever differences and nuances there might be, and it drowns out their voices. And unfortunately, it is incredibly successful. That leads me to the next question, really, which is on the impact of the film, because you're creating a very, very personal sort of product here. It doesn't deal in the big issues of geopolitics, or well, it touches upon them, of course, because we're going to talk about some of the resistance, some of the sort of especially right-wing resistance to displaced people and existing social issues which are exacerbated and leveraged. Well, we'll park that for a minute. We'll come back to that because I think this is an important aspect of the film as well. But the impact is important because you're telling a story about individuals, and what you want is for other individuals for that to resonate with them, and I'm assuming for them to take action as well. So, what is the desired impact? What in your wildest dreams will the film achieve in terms of sort of shaping and changing people's behaviors?
These sorts of views in the current landscape, people are entrenched a little bit more than they used to be with these sorts of views. So we're talking about, influence from a, and we've got to be very, honest about how difficult it is to influence anybody now. But I think the purpose of concentrating on the stories and in the way that we are is that we felt like when we were there, and we were there, the original trip, which was a week long back in May 2022, was to potentially make a short film based on filming there with a couple of families for that period of time, 5 days, 6 days, whatever it was that we spent there then. While we were there, myself and Jackie, we connected with three families, and it became immediately apparent in a conversation I had with Steve while we were there, we changed the brief. So we realized that actually we had the potential to do something that if we committed to a longer term process and we filmed more with these people over a longer period of time, we would actually be able to witness the ups and downs of their journey over a period of time. And in doing that, the telling of their story would be much more authentic, more fly on the wall, observational, poetic from a, and that's creatively something that I thought would be important for this project too, because of the subtleties and the nuances that we knew we would need to depict. But yeah, the impact comes from being able to talk with honesty over and depict these stories evolve over a long period of time. And I think by showing that, by being able to show that we stuck with the story for that period of time and we watched these families go through the things that they went through, the challenges, overcome obstacles, connect with the local community, etc., is that actually fundamentally what we show is the challenges to do with assimilation and integrating and, you know, finding work and feeling, you know, empowered in new places. And I think that is the heart of the film. And I think it needed to be, you know, something that we committed to for a long period of time to be able to do that. So other people, when they watch it, and, you know, ideally what we're thinking about here are the people in the host communities, they peep behind the curtain. Because a lot of them are only really, unless they know firsthand, and some, you know, there are many who do, you know, those who don't have firsthand experience of what Ukrainian people are going through, who are displaced, this film will fill in the gap, you know, quite a substantial one. And I think it will do that with more power and emotional power as a consequence of us being able to stick with the story for the time that we did.
And Daria, this is part of your lived experience. You've bumped up against the challenges, as well as some of the sort of more subtle things, which is people who think they're being welcoming, but potentially continuously remind you that you're an outsider, etc. So for you, what is the anticipated sort of impact of this film?
I think also what I really love about this film is that we're seeing three different families from different backgrounds. So it kind of shows the wider scope of people, and it's not just, you know, the people, the kind of people that I can relate to. So I think the long-term impact of this film would be to, you know, see that we are really hard-working people who just want to proceed with their lives, and it wasn't necessarily a choice to end up here. Or, well, I'm in London and they're in rural community in Ireland, so it wasn't like necessarily a decision, but they're doing their best to be able to have some kind of normal lives. And it's not always easy, but one of the main stereotypes that I faced, and I think many people, many other displaced people have faced, is that, you know, we just came here for a better life or to live off the benefits, and it's just not true. So for me, one of the biggest impacts of this film would be to show that, we're working really hard to make it all happen.
Yeah, 100%, I'd agree. I mean, that was the thing that struck Jackie and I that week we were there. We were like, these people are not here to sponge off the state. There's been unprecedented support in, you know, in Ireland in particular, you know, across Europe, but in Ireland in particular, there was unprecedented support. Local people opened their arms. You know, there was a huge amount of generosity, huge amount of support. But the people that we met that week, struck us was just how much they were grateful, but that they wanted to put their own 2 feet on the floor and walk forwards, you know. And I think that was really, we felt the power of that in that first 5 days. And that was something that, you know, we wanted to depict.
And Diary, you, when we were preparing for this video yesterday, you came out with a remarkable phrase, which I think will really resonate with people. And that's the idea that Ukrainians, and this is very broadly speaking, not everyone's going to feel this way, but it does align with, I think, you know, certainly Stephen and I experiencing talking to many hundreds of Ukrainians now. You said that people, if they're not working, if they don't have a project, if they're not busy, then there's this sort of overwhelming sense of guilt. Now, I found that very moving, but also a very powerful idea to dispel some of these myths.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, you already said the exact thing that I'm feeling, but I don't know anyone from my country who is not having this feeling of guilt. And whoever I'm speaking to, I'm freelance, for example, which is a very privileged thing to be. But all the other freelance people who are, I know, if they don't have work for like a month, they just go crazy because it's like, oh, I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing anything. I'm, you know, receiving support. But like, what am I doing with my life? I need to send more emails. So it's just a constant thing I experience and see as well.
That's extraordinary. And before we get on to the myth busting part of the interview, Stephen, I mean, what in your wildest dreams really is going to be the impact of this, and how many people do you hope are affected by its message?
So I hope a lot of people are affected by the message. And I think for me, it's about breaking down walls, creating empathy and creating a strong kind of sense of understanding through the lens of humanity and universalism. And but also understanding the kind of struggles that people have gone through, the kind of the ups, the downs, and the kind of issues that people have kind of faced, and how that can kind of be turned around.
For me, like as someone who identifies, I have ancestors in Ireland, but I'm not Irish, and I'm not Ukrainian. So, and I'm directing this, so I had to be really clear, and it was difficult. It was difficult for me to, connect with the subject in a way that I felt was authentic and like I had something to say. For me, one of the most important things, well, that's why it was being really important to work with Daria on the project. But one of the things that I felt really strongly and I identified with was the idea that host communities had the capacity to not be open, had the capacity to turn their back, had the capacity to be judgmental, and be suspicious of the people who have moved in next door, And for me, the impact, in a nutshell, for me, the impact that I'd like to have with the film is that people are slightly less quick to do any of those things as a consequence of watching it.
That's obviously, an extremely important aspect of assimilating and helping the displaced people to get through what we have to say has been, for many, an extremely traumatic experience. So let's turn to that question, the from and the to. So obviously, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have had to flee their homes. For some of them, their homes are still there, but are in a precarious or dangerous position, or they may no longer have the sort of employment they had to be able to sustain their lives there. For others, and I know this from local experience, in Oxfordshire, where I am, families from Mariupol, whose homes have been obliterated and all their possessions and their entire life has been left behind. So when it came to your film, who have you based it on? Where are they from? And what sort of diverse experiences have they had in terms of where they've come from?
One of the families is Kate, and she's a single mom. She's not a single mom. Her husband is fighting in Ukraine. She has two kids, and she used to have a very successful law career in Ukraine, but then she couldn't proceed with it and still guarantee the safety for her kids. So she's in a very hard position, and she's far from her husband, and she's in the country where she had to learn all the new ways of being able to do what she's been trained for law there. And she, I think she originally comes from Odessa, which is also where I'm from, and it's a sea port town in the south of Ukraine. And then she moved to Kiev, where she was residing with her husband and kids before the full-scale invasion. Then we have Marina. She is a single mom of, about four kids, yes, and her oldest kid already has her own child, so she's a grandmother, and then the youngest ones, they're all school children, and she comes from Kryvyi Rih, which is where our president is from, and it's an eastern city, and she is, I'm not quite sure what her work situation was before.
She was like a security guard.
Oh yes, yeah, she was a security guard, but like, unlike Kate, the first mom, she didn't have any specific knowledge of the language, and she chose the country absolutely randomly just to save her kids and her granddaughter. So, yes, and then the third family is Victor, who's I believe 76 or 75.
Yeah, yeah.
And he came to Ireland with his wife and daughter from Lviv, which is a Western city. And even though it was quite close to the border and relatively safe in the first months of the invasion, his family's work situation kind of was tricky in a way that they were at high risk of danger. So they had to move for that reason as well. And yes, I think
I think one of the, we did a lot of, I had a lot of conversations before we went over there. That first week in May 2022, when we were there, It became clear that these were a good group to work with because they're from very different backgrounds. You know, not only are they from different parts of Ukraine, but actually fundamentally, the idea of exploring the democratization of this experience through people who have very different backgrounds before they ended up in this rural community in Ireland, most of them at random, as Daria alluded to. They literally didn't know where they were going. They got on an aeroplane, they got off it, they got on a bus in the dark, and they woke up in this, you know, rural place in the middle of nowhere, as far as they were concerned, you know, like they literally didn't know that's where they would end up. They were chosen because of the differences in terms of their socioeconomic differences, as well as their ages. You know, we've got, you know, multi-generations, spread from, you know, someone who's four to someone who's 76, as Daria says.
And a key aspect of the film, so we've got a diverse set of people, diverse, sources, as it were, of, how they sit in society, education, age, all this kind of stuff. But they all end up in rural Ireland. And there are certain challenges there. Now, this film also goes into busting quite a few of the myths. This won't just be myths held by, people in Ireland or host families. These are myths that can be found in any country, in any society, I think, that encounters displaced people. I'm going to give you a chance, each in turn to go through one of those myths, because I think this is a central part of the film, and it's a central part of the, if you can call it a lesson. I mean, it's hopefully the film is not to feel like a lesson, but it's important that these messages come across. So, yeah, could you each tackle a different one of the myth-busting purposes behind it?
One of them, for sure, is, like, we've already alluded to it a little bit, and it was something that was really strongly, there when we first met these people, and that was their desire to have agency and their desire to be creative and participatory in the local community which they now live. And in conversations that I've had subsequently as the years have gone by, and actually during that time we rubbed shoulders with some pretty difficult customers in Ireland, and there are everywhere people who have quite toxic views relating to immigration, which we're coming on to later. But one of the ones that's really prominent is this idea that people have come in order to sponge off the state. And that just isn't the case, and it isn't the case for the families that the working families. Okay, the people who are retired are in a different scenario, a different life stage. But the two families with the mums and young children, they want to work. They want to move forward. They want momentum. They want autonomy.
What's the biggest myth busting sort of segment for you here, or the most important message?
So I think there's two. So I think the first one's kind of really building on kind of Daniel's. And I think it's the general kind of myth that all displaced people are draining the kind of resources. So they're a drain on the resources, and they're taking the resources that could kind of go to you, and they're taking kind of education and taking hospitals and all the other aspects. But I think there's a bigger one. I think the big one is this concept that we're different, yeah. This idea that Ukrainians are kind of outsiders, that they're completely kind of different from the kind of Irish kind of community. And obviously, you have kind of differences in kind of culture, but we're all essentially kind of humans, right? And I think that outsider myth is a myth that is constantly played in kind of the Russian kind of handbook, right? They've had 30 years of playing the outsider. As Putin started with the Chechens, then it was kind of the oligarchs, then it's the gays, then it's kind of the Georgians, now it's the kind of Ukrainians, right? But they're using that playbook in kind of democracies to create a tension within.
Well, I'm going to ask Daria. I mean, I know you'll have lots and lots of myths, so I'm going to ask you to come up with as many as you need to. But I'm going to start by putting a couple that I've heard to you and see what you think. I mean, first of all, there's the Russian propaganda narrative that somehow Ukraine is irredeemably corrupt. And unfortunately, that message does get through. Propaganda is very pervasive. But of course, it's not going to be part of everybody's everyday lived experience. And the individuals coming over are not going to be, corrupt, etc. But it'd be interesting to hear if you've come across that one. The other one, I think, is very important. And this is, I think, anyone who's either going either displaced through war or is changing society per se. I mean, I know that from sort of personal experiences in my family. This is the assumption that the people are coming from a society that is less educated, less sophisticated, less urban. Often quite the reverse is true. And I know this talking to the family from Mariupol, a highly developed city, play areas for the kids, everywhere, sophisticated, coffee house culture, theatres, and all the rest. So those are the two that I'm going to sort of spring on you, but I'd love to hear your response to that and other myths that you would like to dissect.
Sure, absolutely. I think in terms of corruption, there is one interesting thing that I'd like to highlight, and this is the conversations I've been having and also the conversations I've been witnessing in group chats about taxes. Because here, people, well, other Ukrainians and myself, when we came here and saw the kind of, structure that could be provided to citizens in terms of like medical help and then transport and education. Mental health support. So everyone is willing to pay taxes because, it feels like we have to contribute and we have to like maybe pay back in a sense, because obviously all these support programs for displaced people, they didn't come to the state for at no cost. And I think I've also heard this myth about, Ukrainians wanting to come here and get a visa and then get a salary and then like a higher salary than they would get in Ukraine and then come back to the country or just leave suddenly without paying taxes. And I just deeply disagree because yes, I witnessed a lot of will to pay taxes. Yeah, the second one, the less educated society one, it hurts for me personally because I face that a lot. And from phrases like, oh, maybe now that you're here, you'll get a chance to get a degree. So people just assume I don't have one and I have two. And then things, whenever I was trying to, well, not whenever, but often when I was trying to participate in conversations about politics or sociology or anything that's not, basic, hi, how are you doing thing, people were kind of excluding me from conversations because they were assuming again that I wouldn't get it either because of my language skills or because of my education or like the lack of it. And yeah, it's just not true because essentially now that I can, compare, I think that our educational system is still quite powerful, even though it's not as progressive in some ways as it is here in the UK and as it is in Ireland. I think we still, there are so many expectations and so much hard work you have to go through to get a degree or even a high school diploma. So I would say that, yeah, all the myths about lack of education are absolutely not true. And same with culture. Whenever I mention some music or film references or book references, people often get surprised because they're like, oh, this thing, oh, that thing, as if, I wouldn't even have a chance to learn that. And same, for food, coffees, all that stuff. So, yeah, I feel like it's not possible now, but whenever, if there was no war, I would just suggest people to visit Ukraine to see how it actually is, and I'm sure they would enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that to your point, Jonathan, I think Daria mentioned something really important for the film just then as well. Like, which is something we've observed in the families. That particularly those like the working mums and the ones or the younger the daughters in Marina's family who were doing the breadwinning because that was a decision that they made. Marina was to stay at home, look after the young granddaughter, and the two 20-year-olds would go out and and bring home the money for the household to be able to pay its bills, which was challenging. And I think that's really important here too. So this idea of corruption, what this the this Russian propaganda idea that Ukrainians corrupt. So with that comes the notion that Ukrainians themselves are on the make, like, so Ukrainians who end up in Ireland, they're there to take what they can, like not contribute. We've already talked about contribution, but there's something else here, which is something that I don't know whether Daria would agree, but something that was really tangible and quite powerful, again, about the way that, you know, these families are in Ireland, is that they want to do everything right. It's a precarious situation that they're in. Their rights, you know, are, you know, the number of days they're allowed to leave the country, the things they're allowed to do, there's rules about being, you know, in the position. It's a very precarious one. And they don't want to put a foot wrong, you know, and to live with that day in, day out is stressful, you know, not to do something wrong. And they're deeply grateful, and they don't want to put a foot wrong. They're hardly on the make, you know, like, in addition to doing those things in order to not jeopardize their position of security, which is what this is all about. This is just about safety. It's about taking kids mostly away from bombs, or, you know, the fear of bombs, you know, and they don't want to mess that up. So they're hardly going to be there exploiting and looking for levers to pull to get ahead, you know, and exploit something and to the detriment of someone, you know, in the local community. Far from it. They don't want to rub anyone up the wrong way. They want to make friends, you know, they want to assimilate, and they want to just put, you know, they just want to move forwards. And they're stressed by, you know, how precarious that situation is, and they don't want to put a foot wrong.
Yeah, there's another myth as well, which is a big one, but it has to constantly be repeated, and I think people constantly have to be reminded, because Russia doesn't see Ukraine as a nation, right? They see it as fraternal people. Fraternal people? These are people in Ireland who have gone with their suitcases in fear because of the destruction of what's happened by Russia's kind of aggression. There's no fraternal there. Some of the people were actually Russian speakers, two of them were Russian speakers. There's no fraternalism. It's just complete and utter inhumanity.
And, you know, before we move on to the political dimension, there must be an aspect as well, Daria, where you're asked, you know, a set of questions for the first time, you know, in the first days and weeks that you arrive. And in good faith, you give answers to those. But then you're asked the question again and again and again. And no matter how well-meaning the person is, it can become a source, I imagine, of significant mental stress to have to educate people. It shouldn't be your responsibility to educate everybody about everything. How do you deal with this? Because you also have to make connections. You also have to talk to people. How do you avoid the mental stress of being constantly othered by well-meaning questions?
I mean, to be fair, I'm not dealing with it very well. And I think when I just came here 2 years ago, I was naive in some way. And I was just assuming that, first of all, people are, to be fair, I would love to educate if people are willing to listen, but often they're not even willing to listen because the very topic of the war is painful or stressful. I don't know, but now it's kind of the opposite. I'm scared to even mention that in conversations with you know, friends or like peers, or especially at work, because no one wants to carry the trauma, no one wants to face the trauma, and I'm kind of hiding it. And what I've noticed the other day is that when I'm at the airport, I'm kind of hiding my passport when I'm queuing for something, because there is some kind of shame, which is absolutely not healthy. And obviously, I didn't have it before coming here. So, I'm not dealing with this very well. It is stressful. And even though I got brilliant mental health support from the state and a few, you know, courses with specialists, it feels like I would need, you know, a constant support, because it doesn't go away anywhere. And the feeling of being alienated and just never fitting in properly, and fitting in terms of, you know, people smiling or doing some formal things, ticking the boxes, but to actually make good connections, to actually make friends, all of that has proved to be incredibly tricky. And I've never had a problem with this before in my entire life. And I've lived in three different countries before coming to the UK. So it's quite interesting.
Now let's turn to something I would say darker, because, you know, a lot of people who are contributing to that stress are not necessarily aware that they're doing that. But there are people who are extremely manipulative. There are people who are using existing social and political tensions, and weaponizing the issue of displaced people. So, Daniel, let's turn to you first. You do tackle this in the film, whereas Ireland was extraordinarily generous in not placing a cap on the number of people who are allowed in. And they seem to deal much better with the bureaucracy and sweeping that to one side to smooth the path for Ukrainians to come to Ireland very early in the war, when it has to be said the UK was really struggling and still putting up a lot of barriers to people coming over. There have, however, been a negative side, which is the weaponization of this issue by people, especially on the far right. So, how do you tackle this in the film? Because, of course, you've got to balance this with the fact that so many people have been so generous and Ireland as a state has been so generous, but there is this dark side.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that Daria and I and Steve, we're still discussing. We're still trying to figure out the right approach to get the balance right. So what we have done so far is film for 14 months with the families that, Daria and I were talking about earlier. And we've witnessed the experiences that they've had. And in that process, we sort of, like there are little overlaps. So, there's moments where, and that's very rare and they're very small. And that's like to your point just then about the generosity, the overwhelming fact that the majority of people in Ireland and elsewhere have been open and supportive. But it's there are elements within societies that aren't, and to what degree that filters down to, someone who might walk past in a street is the point here, isn't it? And for one of the families, it'll be in the film, a couple of the girls, Irina, who's Marina's 20-year-old daughter, is walking through a street locally, and someone shouts at her an abusive, term in the street. That was really difficult for her to hear, and it rocked them. It rocked their confidence and made them feel like they couldn't go out. And they're very small moments, but they're packed with power, So we witnessed it on a small scale, and so the film goes there just in that way, in that observational way, with moments that we were able to witness with them and pick with them, but they were rare. So we do have to make an intention with the film to overtly explore in some way. And I think, what we're trying to figure out is to what degree we do that as a framing thing at the beginning of the film, or whether or not we weave some of it within the narrative arc as well. So this is it's a decision that we haven't made yet. I think what we will do, though, for sure, to your point, Jonathan, is we need to say, there was the story of the Ukrainian wave of, displaced people, occurred from, May 2022. But there are issues with these kind of discourses that stretch back a long period of time before that, not just 20 years, hundreds of years, if you want to talk about liberal, the way that racism is ingrained in liberalism, the way that, the working classes were raised up by us enslaving Africa, in order to have our societies as the way that we have them now. And when things get tough, when we're in corners in economic hardship occurs, that's where we're vulnerable to people exploiting that kind of sentiment that still sits structurally beneath the surface in places. But the film's obviously not going to go there. It's not an essay. It's not an analysis of this kind of thing. But I think we do need to frame the generosity with which the Irish state responded quickly to people who were needing to flee from Ukraine, in as much as I think it's important to talk about the economic situation and the local history of the area that we're operating in as a sort of which is a sort of a small a metaphor for the other places in other parts of Ireland, which is their rural communities. And in these rural communities, they actually, a lot more Ukrainians ended up in these rural communities that were already stretched in Ireland by a lack of government spending on services, infrastructure, so there were that, that these are sort of scenarios where there was going to be tension, and we felt that first week. We felt like that we imagined that there would be tensions that these people would be facing. So that's why one of the other reasons why we thought following out over time would be really important to see what ways they manifest. Fortunately, they didn't manifest in many ways, but they did manifest. So yeah, I think we need to to contextualize it from the point of view of saying rural communities, stretched resources, underspending, creates a slightly tricky territory for someone like, Marina's family coming there with her four kids and a granddaughter to make that work for them in a way that doesn't, ostracize them.
And this is a question really for Stephen here, because we've seen in Dublin the riots, and various analysis has been done on why those, but they're incredibly extensive, and the issue of immigration was a contributing factor for some people involved in those riots for sure. But it's interesting that that's happening in Dublin, but many of these displaced people are actually ending up in the countryside. So those who are doing the rioting may not even actually have any direct contact at all. So how do you see this as the sort of weaponization of the issue from people who may actually not have may not have been disadvantaged in any way by having these people come into their society?
So I think there's two separate points here. So I think the first one is that the far right, like the idea of any idea that's kind of misery is company, right? So any chance they get to exploit a kind of weakness and especially an othering, they take on the local initiatives, right? So they take on local initiatives and try and kind of push that through on the agenda. I think when it comes to Russian propaganda is crafty, sly, and cunning. So the beginning of the escalation of the war, the mainstream news cycle, welcome displaced Ukrainians, pro-Ukraine, constantly on the media narrative. At that time, the Russian troll farms were quiet. What they did is they waited for it to drop out of the mainstream news cycle, and then they go for the little clefts, the little areas. And one of the areas that's developed over time is kind of is obviously the tension within the kind of community and that whole idea about kind of resources. And that's kind of how kind of Russian kind of propaganda works. It waits like a cuckoo for an issue and then just pounces on that kind of issue when things get kind of difficult, and they can see those little ruptures happening. It's a bit like it's a long game, right? And that's what we're not good at in the West. We don't play the long game. Putin and Russia are playing the long game. They've always played the long game. They're waiting for frictions. You're seeing it in geopolitics, but you're seeing it on a local level in Ireland. They're waiting for those friction points so they can then pounce in.
During the peak of the exodus of people coming through Lviv and other border crossings, so many news outlets, to an extent, they didn't ignore the sort of 99.999% story, which is of Ukrainians being displaced through a violent Russian invasion. They focused, many stories focused, on supposed racist treatment of a small number of non-white, non-Ukrainian citizens. And at the time, I myself didn't question it fully. I thought, well, maybe there is a little bit of this stuff going on, but it's not the big story. So why are you focusing on it? In hindsight, it makes me think that actually, all the contact I've had with Ukrainians and individuals suggests to me that it's an extremely tolerant society. So now I even doubt whether this racist attitude even existed or happened. It's a sort of manufactured story. Do we see this also happening in relation to displaced people, placing values upon them that actually they do not possess?
I mean, they always place a kind of alienness, and they play onto stereotypes and extend those kind of stereotypes. I think what you're talking about is really, really interesting, because that was something I noticed. And I think, look, there was some documented one or two occasions where that may well have kind of happened. But at the time, my friends were trapped in Mariupol. They couldn't even get to the Lviv border, yeah? And I think that, and it was a time of chaos. Everyone was trying to get to the border. But the way Russia operates, and I think Russian propaganda, it plays two sides. The same troll factory will be doing far-right messages about immigration and Black Lives Matter communications and things about racism and Ukraine's racist, right? Same people, same troll factory. So the same troll factory will be turning out the same kind of narratives. And I think we just need to be kind of wise to that. But I think any idea of kind of the outsider is really, really kind of important. And Russia got strong ties with the far right. It's kind of well known from kind of Le Pen in France, the National Front in the UK, Tommy Robinson in the UK. It's got strong ties. It's always kind of had kind of strong ties, and it will kind of use that to manipulate. And do you remember with Syria that there was a whole thing, let's push immigration into Europe to create the kind of left, right? They play the weapon. They play the weapon because they want to. Well, democracy is fantastic, and I love democracy, but it's different sides, and they focus in on that different sides. And when you're in echo chambers, that will be amplified.
And Dario, I don't know if you have a take on this, because observing the Western media, especially when it seems to be falling for Russian narratives, must be an intense frustration.
Yeah, I'm not just observing it as much as I was 2 years ago, and it's probably a bit too, neglectant in a way, but also it just hurts so much to be like consuming so much of information that's related to myself. But this is the narrative I'm facing a lot, that I'm a privileged displaced person, and I agree with this in some sense, and I'm grateful for the way I'm being accepted here and for all the practical aspects. But people often don't see the pain behind the situation, because my experience of fleeing the war wasn't as heavy as it was for many other displaced people from many other war zones and conflicts.
There's no room for immigration, right, or displaced people top trumps. Yeah, it's not a top trump game, right? It's all about kind of humanity, yeah, and a lot of it's caused by brutality of regimes like Russia.
But the point I make there, and we're not going to be too political about this, but for a lawyer who's based in the UK, I think a more nuanced response would be that Britain was one of the signatories to the Budapest memorandums. We claim to guarantee Ukraine's sovereignty in return for them giving up the weapons and tools they would have been able to defend themselves with. So it's all very well creating this sort of, this even playing field and saying, Ukrainians are privileged. We have been instrumental in enabling this situation. So we have an especial, I would say, responsibility to help Ukrainians as a signatory to the Budapest Memorandum, as a country which created Londongrad, which allowed Russian oligarchs to cleanse their stolen money here and perpetuate the Putin regime. So I think, you're too polite to hit back hard against these people, but I would give them a verbal punch in the face if I heard that. Let's sort of come to the sort of concluding question, I think, which is the state of funding. Now, when we were planning this episode, you'd set a fairly sort of conservative budget to or target to try and get funding to complete the film and of course get it distributed and get the largest possible audience. Well, the amazing news just before we started recording is that you've actually exceeded that funding target. But I would guess that more is definitely going to help bring this film to a much broader audience. So what's the situation with the funding? What's the next stage with the film? How are you going to get it to the biggest possible audience you can, and hopefully get media attention onto the story as well?
Yeah, okay, so you're right. We have been really lucky. And we've had a lot of support. I mean, for 2 years, Daria, myself, Steve, and Jackie and Hannah have been laboring on this as a sort of a labor of love, really. It's pro bono for most of us. There's not a lot of money on the table, if any, for our time. But we felt compelled to keep going because we knew that had potential. And I think what's happened, and it's been really nice, is that, like the second we pressed launch 2 weeks ago on the Kickstarter campaign, was that Other people, sort of it resonated with other people, and other people fit this potential too. And it's really empowering, like it's encouraging, and we're feeling really genuinely grateful that it's had that kind of quick, warm reception, and that we're over the budget by 128% now, I think, before we started recording this, which is we've still got 12 days to run. So you're right. What we did, because we weren't sure about what the reception would be, we did set a conservative target. We wanted to make sure that we could do the bare minimum to get it finished, on a shoestring budget. But now, we do have the shoestring budget, we can actually try to do an even better job with the film. So we increase the production values of the film. But by using archive footage, and archive footage would help us tell the story about the local context and some of the sort of setting the stories of these three Ukrainian families in a bit of the context we talked about earlier, which is really important, to discuss the local community and have a voice for the local community in some way, I think is something that we want to explore with what we're calling our stretch goals, which might well encompass a trip to Ireland to possibly film a little bit more with people from the local community in order to be able to depict some of the tensions that were there before the Ukrainian families even got there that, were always going to, be difficult to navigate, with more people in these communities, needing access to the same services. So I think we'd like to achieve that. So those are two things that we'd like to try to do with some additional funding. And all these things, are relatively expensive. We're in the thousands of pounds for each of those two elements. One thing that's really important to do with the local voice as well is having a screening, an official screening of the film, a private screening once we finish. We've got one in London. It's one of the pledges that you get to come to a screening in London, before it's released either on a festival run or through any kind of other distribution. And we would like to offer that in Ireland. It's more expensive for us to do that. It's a stretch goal. And then finally, and really importantly, Hannah Tukey, who is, producing this with me, she's an impact producer. And all along, she came onto the project when she saw it had potential because she felt like we could do more once we actually had the film made. That's where for her it comes to life in a different way. And I was talking with her briefly just before the call about what that might look like. And she was basically saying, look, the right amount of money will enable us to be able to do things like a series of workshops facilitated by local people, carefully recruited, event hire, space hire for those workshops with a screening and inviting communities to come and, people from the Ukrainian diaspora, but also people from the local Irish communities, wherever we are able to do these screenings and elsewhere, and create a conversation that will have real world impact, because not only could we invite local community members, but we would also possibly be able to engage and invite policy decision makers as well, people who are making decisions about, locally how resources get spent, what support there is, etc. going forward.
And Daria, do you think this is a film which Ukrainians should watch as well? Do you think they would get some value out of this by seeing that their own experience is sort of not unique, but is something they perhaps share with others who've been on a similar journey?
Definitely, yes. And I think we should talk about two groups of Ukrainians, those who have left the country and those who have stayed. So for those who have left, it would be a great film to see, just to be able to relate to something, because as I've mentioned before, the experience of being displaced is quite alienating. So just to see that everyone is going through the same problems and just to feel that you're not alone in it, I think it's like one of the biggest purposes of any kind of art, but of this film especially. And then for Ukrainians who couldn't leave the country or chose to stay there, I think it might also be useful or interesting to see, because even though the film will be quite subtle and poetic and beautiful, we, I think, would still want to show the struggle. And there is another kind of stereotype from the Ukrainians who stayed in the country that those who have left are living their best lives and just enjoying and forgetting about everything that's happening at home. And the truth is we don't forget it, we keep remembering it, and it keeps hurting. And there are so many mixed feelings about wanting to come back but not being able to come back, and so on and so forth. So I am sure that it would be an interesting film to see for both Ukrainians who stayed and both and Ukrainians who have left.
Yeah, I think to that point, Daria, it makes a really interesting point, and something that we observed in, certainly two of the families was this constant push and pull with, where are we going to be in the future? Are we going to be here? Are we going to go back? You know, and what would it look like in either of those two scenarios? And there's this sort of constant sense of suspended animation that sort of like, you know, that they seem to be in, you know, like when, you know, they don't know when this is going to end, and they don't know where they're going to be at the end of it. Still to this day, they wouldn't be able to tell you, you know, like what the outcome's going to be for them. And that's extremely difficult to live with, that level of uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think that's why this film will be also interesting for non-Ukrainian people, because we can't plan our lives in any possible way. And whenever someone is talking to me about plans in like 2 or 3 months ahead, or some, you know, reservations or concerts, none of us can plan these things. We don't know whether it will be here, or maybe we'll be sent away, or the war will be over, or maybe it won't. Same with the visa, because we don't know whether it will be extended anymore or not, or shall we jump another visa, or, you know, shall we stay on this one and see where it goes? Because the level of uncertainty is really hard to communicate in real life conversations. So I think this kind of film, well, our film, will be really helpful for that purpose.
Yeah, I agree. And one thing that actually, you know, like circling back to the question, one of the questions you asked me right at the outset, which was, what's the impact that you hope to have with the film? I think one thing I didn't make really clear for me, you know, and I know Daria too, and everyone else, is that the human connection is at the heart of this film. It was the reason why when Jackie and I went there that in May 2022, that we engaged the way we did with the people that we met, and we committed to do it. And Steve, we brought Steve with us, and he fully embraced it. And he's largely bankrolled the process, you know, like to this point, and being able to follow those stories over time, because the connections we made with those people, it's the most authentic reason to make a documentary, you know, like, which is, I think, what's powered us through, you know, like, because it's been difficult, I won't lie. But the reason that we wanted to make it was because we can forge connection through the film and the way that it's received with an audience. And by that, what I mean is, okay, we can talk about the structural and racism that is in liberal democracies. We can talk about the challenges in Ireland from a kind of like government spend point of view in rural communities where a lot of Ukrainians live, and where these families live in County Mayo in Ireland. And we can talk about some of the tensions in the local community that were inevitable, and that we do witness a little bit in the film. We do discuss a little bit, and the darkness in the other narratives that we talked about earlier, in terms of the way that international actors have exploited that and continue to do so by training and grooming local people to, you know, lean in here with far right propaganda. But ultimately, I think the story of the film is one of hope. Like, it's a story of how in these scenarios, people do connect, people can form friendships, people can find ways to move forward, and the love of the family is strong, and the strength of these families is incredible, and it pulls them through. But so does the small links that some of them make with the local Irish community. So in spite of these communities being stretched before Ukrainians arrived, and in spite of it being challenging 2 years later, and these other influences, what's remarkable is that, you know, the Irish people have embraced, in the main, people in their communities, you know, and there is warmth, and they still have that, you know, the warmth of that embrace. And that's something to celebrate too. So the film does end in a hopeful place, actually. It's not all dark, you know, like the journey we want to take people on is one of hope in the power of human connection, I think, ultimately, for me anyway. I mean, it sounds slightly cheesy when I say it out loud, but it's what motivated me to tell the story in the first place, I think.
And that's incredibly positive, because we see so many films, fantastic films, incredible films like 20 Days in Mariupol, but they are fundamentally deeply traumatic. And it's in many ways traumatizing watching it. I know people involved in the creation of that film, in the translation subtitling. And it's been a deeply traumatizizing experience, you know, working with that. It sounds like, you know, something that's got shades of light and dark, but actually has a sense of optimism is definitely worthwhile. I very much look forward to seeing it. I have to admit to the audience, I haven't seen it yet. It's not a finished film at this point, but I very much look forward to seeing it on the big screen, and to people who've bankrolled it, people who are engaged with the topic, coming to the cinema or institute or wherever you're going to have the opening night, and really, you know, see them engage with the film and then see them engage with the filmmakers on stage and see the wider impact it has. Thank you so much for coming on to the channel. Daniel, Stephen, Daria, it's been a huge privilege, and I wish you every success in what is a fantastic project.
Thanks for having us. And can I take this opportunity just to say a huge thank you to everyone over the whole 2 years, not just the people who've supported the Kickstarter campaign, but everybody who's supported all of us financially and otherwise, you know, in what's been a tough journey. But we're all excited because I think we can see the end now. And I think we're starting to believe the impact we can make. And it's exciting to be in this position. So thank you to everyone who supported us.